The purpose of Retire with Style is to help you discover the retirement income plan that is right for you. The first step is to discover your retirement income personality. Start by going to risaprofile.com/style and sign up to take the industry's first financial personality tool for retirement planning. Today's episode features Michael Finke, a professor of wealth management, and the Frank M. Engel Distinguished Chair in Economic Security Research at the American College of Financial Services. He is a nationally known researcher in retirement income planning and is a frequent speaker at financial planning conferences around the country. Finke was named one of the 25 most influential people in the field of investment advising in 2020 and 2021 by Investment Advisor magazine. The only consumption smoothing discussed in this episode has nothing to do with spending in retirement. Or does it? Let's hope it's the former.
Welcome, everyone, to Retire with Style. I'm Alex Merguia.
And I'm Wade Fowle. And I'm very happy to introduce our guest this week, who's actually now our first two-time guest at Retirement with Style. It's Michael Finke, professor of wealth management at the American College of Financial Services. And we just had him as a guest in our past episode, but so much to talk about that we thought it was worth having a second episode to dive more into some of these topics. In particular, Michael, we'd really like to talk more about retirement spending with you and what that consists of, how that might change over time and so forth. And to start that, what came up with our last episode a little bit was this idea of retirees having, and it goes by a lot of different names. I usually use the terms essential and discretionary expenses. I think recently you've been using more the terminology of inflexible and flexible expenses in retirement. So could you just talk about some of the research you've been doing in the area of defining retirement expenses more generally?
Yeah, Wade, just as a background, when we look at retirement spending, one of the data sets that we very often use is the Health and Retirement Study, which has a consumption element in it. So the people actually have to fill out what they're spending money on before and after retirement. It's longitudinal, which means we can look at how they spent money before retirement. We can look at how they spent money after retirement. And first of all, one of the most interesting things is that there's not much of a difference in how they spend money before and after retirement. JP Morgan has also done some research on this that's actually tracked people's spending over time. And I think when it comes right down to it, we're creatures of habit. So we tend to live in the same house, we pay the same property taxes, we go to the same grocery stores, we go shopping, we go to the same places. Generally speaking, our expenses are about the same. Now we may go on vacations more frequently in retirement, we may have some adjustments in how we spend money, but the year after we retire looks a lot like the year before we retire. Now, what JP Morgan has found is that some people go a little bit crazy. They spend a ton of money early on in retirement. But generally speaking, what happens is that evens out over time. So people, they buy their RV and then they decide to cut back on spending later on. They don't have, or maybe they go on a lot the European vacation and then they go back to normal life afterwards. So spending, if you want to plan on what your lifestyle is going to look like, it's probably going to look a lot like the lifestyle you had before retirement. That's also a good way of figuring out whether you have enough is, and I know that there's a PhD economist, also financial advisor who runs a place called Sensible Financial. His name is Rick Miller. And what Rick says is that you have enough saved for retirement if you can cover your desired lifestyle with safe investments. So if you can cover your desired lifestyle with the money that you already have saved up, then you have enough. Then anything above that is essentially gravy. And essentially, if you can cover the lifestyle you had before retirement that with the assets that you saved, then you have enough. A lot of us don't have enough to cover that exactly, but it's important to pay some attention to it. The other thing we find is that the amount of money that we spend before retirement, there is this idea that you might need to replace 80% of your gross income before retirement. That's unrealistic for a lot of higher income retirees. Why? Because they may have been taking up they've been taking advantage of their catch-up contributions. They're saving 20% of their income already. They're not spending that money. They've got payroll taxes. They've got a lot of things that they don't have to spend money on after retirement. So actually what we find is that maybe closer to a 55 or 60% replacement rate is really more accurate for someone who's making, say, $200,000 a year. They've got to replace or at least they should hope to replace a lifestyle of about $120,000 per year. Now, part of that lifestyle, and we had this discussion previously about flexible and what I like to call flexible and inflexible expenses. I call inflexible expenses inflexible because I want to make sure that the asset solution or, you know, the product solution that we have to cover those expenses does not require some sort of a risk premium, some sort of a bonus, because you can't cut back if you don't get that bonus for taking investment risk. And what we find is also about two-thirds of total spending is in these inflexible categories. Now, everybody has their categories of inflexible spending, you know, and my definition of what's inflexible may be different from your definition of what's inflexible. Obviously, I've got to pay property taxes on my house that I want to live in retirement. I'm going to have maintenance expenses. I've got, you know, to pay my utilities, my insurance. Those are all inflexible. I've got to eat. No matter what happens, I've got to cover those. Other people might say that other lifestyle expenses are also inflexible. So for some people, you know, pet grooming is an inflexible expense, which means that you shouldn't necessarily cover that part of your lifestyle with any sort of a strategy that involves reliance on market returns, because if you don't get them, then you're going to be forced to cut back. Is golf an inflexible expense or is it a flexible expense? For some people, that's a big part of their enjoyment in retirement. They're not going to cut back if the market's not doing as well. So for them, that's how they should define what's inflexible and what's flexible. And I think it's a conversation, whether you're doing your own retirement income planning or whether you're working with an advisor, it's a conversation you absolutely need to have, is what part of your budget do you want to lock in with either with safe investments or some other type of a strategy to make sure that you don't have to cut back on that part of your budget. You don't have to worry about ever having to cut back on that part of your budget. And what part of your expenses are truly more flexible? Now, Wade, I know you and I have talked about this. Now, we're really focusing on maybe the first 5 years of retirement when we're talking about replacing that same lifestyle that we had before retirement. But other people, David Blanchett in particular, have done a lot of research on spending and retirement over time. And they find that spending is not constant over time, that you do change as you get older.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. David. So there's this idea that's been around for a long time of the go-go years, the slow-go years, and the no-go years, which just mainly speaks to how some of the discretionary flexible spending decreases throughout retirement. David Blanchett talks about the idea of the retirement spending smile, which is important to think about because when you compare to the 4% rule, you know, for many reasons, 4% may be overstating a truly sustainable spending rate. But one area where it may be overly conservative is it assumes lifestyle grows with inflation throughout retirement. And with David Blanchett's spending smile concept of actually measuring how spending changes over retirement, spending does not keep up with inflation. It tends to decline from one's 60s down into somewhere in their mid-80s. It continues to decline in real purchasing power terms. And then with late in life, long-term care or healthcare expenses, it starts coming up again, but it never gets even close to the constant inflation adjusted spending assumption. And he's talked about this point. I ran the simulations, like if Bill Bengen's 4% rule was applied to his spending smile, I think I had estimated that you could retire with 17% less assets based on the actual observed spending pattern compared to assuming constant inflation-adjusted spending. So that it's a really important issue. And you were saying with the research that you're doing, you found about two-thirds seems to be inflexible, one-third flexible. Are you looking at different categories, or how are you specifically thinking about that? And then also, does that feed into maybe what you're classifying as flexible? The point you're making is for some retirees, they might disagree with that conclusion and say that that is also an inflexible expense.
Yeah, that's exactly right, Wade. So when I was looking at the data, I went into the Consumer Expenditure Survey, which is a very detailed survey of consumer spending conducted by the Bureau of Labor Statistics. And what I did was like by hand. And entirely subjective. You know, I didn't look at which categories were exactly the same over time. I looked at spending categories that I said, you know what, insurance is inflexible. You know, the going out to eat is flexible. I'm going to hand pick each one of these categories and assign them either as inflexible or flexible. I may have been a little bit imprecise in the sense that maybe some spending in an inflexible category is truly flexible. And on the inverse, there may be some in some flexible categories that may be less flexible. But generally speaking, it seemed to, and David Blanchett has done more advanced methodology than my sort of hand collection methodology, and he's come up with pretty much the exact same answer, thankfully, because I always trust his numbers more than my own. But it does seem like it's about two-thirds that's obviously inflexible in retirement. And then I think that has important implications when it comes to what percentage of that spending, even though it's going to decline over time, that flexible spending is going to decline, you're always going to have that foundation of inflexible expenses. So you're always going to have to cover those over time. Some of them will go up with inflation. Some of them won't go up as much with inflation. So, for example, property taxes may be capped in whatever state you live in. In that case, those expenses are what I like to call nominal inflexible expenses. Food at home, I would consider to be an inflation increasing expense as that part of your inflexible category. It's also one of the reasons why I'm a big fan of delaying Social Security, because I think that you want to be able to cover as many of those inflexible expenses that are going to rise with inflation as you possibly can. But it's important to do pay attention to things like, you know, do you have a mortgage? In which case, if it's a fixed mortgage, that's a nominal inflexible expense. You don't need to worry about adjusting that for inflation over time. And all retirees are going to have a mix of both of those. But as you said, people tend to spend less. You know, they buy their RV, they buy their new car when they first retire, and they may never buy another car throughout retirement. There may be, you know, durable expenditures from that flexible category that are very high. You may be going on those big world cruises early on in retirement. But what tends to happen is that you get yourself into a habit of a lifestyle habit, and that doesn't necessarily evolve a whole lot of flexible spending as you hit your mid-70s especially. And then what happens, you know, the other part of that smile is that healthcare expenditures tend to rise. But one of the things that David noticed in his research is that when health expenditures go way up, what tends to happen is that people are not spending a whole lot of money on other stuff. So if you get sick, you're not going on as many vacations, you're not buying as many, you know, new cars, you're in the hospital or you're in a long-term care facility, and you're probably spending all of your budget on that type of an expense. Now, where it gets a little crazy is some people will have these very long-term care expenses, and that can absolutely eat into a financial plan, because, you know, you may end up having $1 million worth of expenses that you hadn't planned on. And especially if it's one spouse who goes into a long-term care facility, the other spouse has to bear the burden of that loss of wealth.
If you're looking for more personal advice, please note that our show is sponsored by McLean Asset Management. Learn more at mcleanam.com. That's mcleanam.com. McLean Asset Management is a wealth management firm where we help you design and implement the right retirement plan for you.
Just to level set for my own benefit here. So roughly speaking, if somebody's listening in and they're thinking about their retirement budget and it happens to be, whatever, $100,000, more or less, $75,000 is probably for inflexible spending. Is that kind of what you...
Yeah, I'd say probably somewhere between 65 and 70 would be truly inflexible.
Yeah, okay.
And that's a good starting point. But then, of course, if people are actually working through the sort of budgeting exercise of looking at their past spending, they can make some judgment calls there as well of maybe, I don't know, just for an example, suppose they'd been spending... $1,000 a year at a restaurant. They might say, okay, we could make some cuts there. Maybe let's say the inflexible part of that is $5,000. The flexible part of that is $3,000. Just making judgment calls with.
No, I think that's Michael's baby back ribs budget at Chili's, right?
$8,000
a year.
What are you talking about? That's my White Castle budget.
You're going to go to Olive Garden or you're going to go to Maggio? Yeah,
the bottomless. Bottomless soup and salad. He can't pass up a good deal.
But you know, Alex, when I talk to retirees and a financial company actually interviewed or hired me a few years ago, there's actually part of a project that Wade and I worked on together.
Sure.
I interviewed retirees and I talked to them about how they spend money on retirement. And very often they were so proud of the fact that they weren't spending very much money. They would tell me these stories about how they would go in early and get these two for one dinners. And, you know, they're not spending down their savings in retirement. They're so proud of that. And then I would ask something like, well, you must really want to pass on that savings to your kids. And they would say, well, no, you know, that's not our main purpose with that money. And I'm like, well, there's only two options here. There's no third option. You can either spend it on lifestyle or you can pass it on. And I think one of the problems with retirement planning is that people are just not deliberate enough about beginning the process by saying, I want to spend this part of my savings, this part I'm willing to pass on, this part is lifestyle.
Yeah, no, 100%.
How do I get the best lifestyle that I can from the money that I've got, recognizing that my spending patterns are probably going to change over time? And if I recognize that, then people probably could be spending a lot more money in their late 60s, early 70s than we might expect. So, you know, Wade and I are very often the voices of gloom and doom when it comes to retirement income planning, that we say, well, people are being over-optimistic with the 4% rule. But in reality, they probably could be spending a lot more than that and living better early in retirement when you're physically and cognitively capable of getting the most enjoyment out of your money.
Couple of observations, I fully agree. You said something at the very beginning that, you know, you say it in 2 seconds, but I think is impactful for years and years, and that's your creatures of habit. And effectively, during the accumulation stage, you're effectively squirreling away money. You're reinvesting it, you're doing such and such, and just because you reach retirement, that habit doesn't necessarily disappear. This habit of, you know, of harvesting savings, of trying to put stuff away. And I think it just continues. And so, Wade, in the last episode, you were talking about behavior coaching. I think it would be better suited to help people on an existential basis know that they can actually spend more money than necessary and enjoy retirement. There's no sense in spending this phase in your life always being apprehensive. So I think there's that behavior stuff that's just locked in. The other piece, and this goes back to strategy, but without opening the whole canvas of strategy, if you're invariably in this total return approach, even if you have like a 95% success rate and you see these pages of data coming at you, I get the sense from working with clients that they still think, okay, that's the advisor's sort of conclusion, but now I need an extra layer of security in my head, so I'm gonna spend a little less because you never know. You know, it's one of those things. It's not like the advisor's conclusion in a Monte Carlo plan is, okay, well, now it's case closed. No, I think it's just this, okay, that's one layer. Now I'm going to put my own layer of safety behind it, which is me being overly conservative. And so then you get to those conversations you have. They're proud of themselves for not spending because of the behavior that's embedded. But then there's also this, and I've got my own safety net. But, you know, 10, 15, 20 years go by, they're now 80 years old, and they don't even have the ability, the physical ability to really spend. And they've potentially lived their retirement age as hermit is too strong of a word, but not unfulfilled to a large extent. Right.
And Michael, too, there's an analogy I use that I'm pretty sure I picked up from you, so it might be worth going back to the original source of it. But the idea of the ant and the grasshopper, the old Aesop's fables. But I believe I've heard you talk about applying that to a lot of individuals who listen to podcasts about retirement are more likely to be like the ant rather than the grasshopper. And it can be very hard to change that mindset after retirement, right?
Wade, for the benefit of those who haven't heard that, you may want to explain what that is.
Yeah, I was going to let Michael.
So,
a question.
My bad, Wade.
We actually wrote a paper on this a few years ago. We followed retirees who before retirement were the ants. So, you know, the parable of the ant and the grasshopper is that, you know, the ant saves up for the winter, saves up food for the winter. The grasshopper dances the summer away, has a great time. Winter comes, the ant has plenty of food. The grasshopper is starving. The grasshopper asks the ant for some food. The ant says no, the grasshopper starves. So this is what I think a children's story used to be in the pre-PC era. It was supposed to teach you that you should always have that habit of thrift. It's morally superior. If you don't save for the future, you will die, which is, you know, a wonderful thing to teach children. But I think we all retain this sort of Protestant work ethic, this habit of thrift, and we spend, we're so proud of the fact that we're spending less than our income, and then we get to retirement, and very often the ants continue to spend less than their income. So they, you know, get Social Security, or they may get some sort of income that they manufacture from their investment portfolio, but they don't want to spend down their savings. And that's because of this psychological barrier that many of us have to seeing our nest egg get smaller in retirement. But that's not rational. Like, why did you save the money in the first place? If you were just going to sit on it and you don't have a very strong desire to pass it on to others, then why did you bother saving all that money? Why didn't you have more fun with the money when you were working? Why didn't you go on more vacations? It's really a psychological problem that a lot of us share. Probably a lot of people listening to this podcast share this psychological problem. I'm not superior. I have the same problem myself. I mean, I have to force myself to spend the money that I save for retirement to live a better lifestyle. But you've got to get over it. Like, you've got, when you're in retirement, you've got to be more like a grasshopper if you're really going to get the most out of that money. Because as Wade's saying, what ends up happening over time is that we do lose our capability of being able to enjoy the money that we saved. I mean, when we're 90, we're not going to be able to do as much fun stuff as we could when we were 70. You know, we're not capable. And even cognitively, we lose some of our capabilities, and the money just doesn't provide as much enjoyment. You know, I gave the example once of that guy who, at the age of, I think, like 94, decided to marry Anna Nicole Smith. He's a Texan, I believe that's true too. Yeah. And you know, I think what happened was he didn't necessarily wanted to pass on all of his wealth to his kids, and he was 94, and he realized he had way too much. And he decided, you know what, I've only got a few years left. I want to spend it with Anna Nicole Smith. So that's an example, I think, of a failure to plan in retirement. Probably could have had a little bit more fun if he would have done that in his 60s and 70s than in his 90s. And we got to get used to that idea that the money is there to be spent to provide a lifestyle. And we can't just continue to be ants in retirement.
I think there's a little known fact. His name was put in the Dallas Cowboys Stadium Ring of Honor.
Oh, really?
No, I'm kidding.
Is that what they're calling it these days?
No. Something that came to mind, and wait, I'm thinking about longevity aversion, and if you have a certain strategy, if you have a total return strategy where you're drawing from a portfolio, you know, you could be listening to this, and my cheeky response could be, Michael, but I'm not going to take it to zero. On the day I die, I mean, I need to leave something there. And so I'm always going to have more assets than I need because I need to have that kind of base to draw from. No one's going to be at 90 thinking, okay, I only have $200,000 left. I'm on track. You know, and so I think that opens up this longevity aversion piece when you're in your 60s and 70s. And maybe if you consider the strategies, it could open up this ability to spend more freely. And I think you've done some work with regards to this confidence in spending once you have contractual income in place, for some at least.
Right. So a lot of even the ants, if they get an income in retirement, they don't feel as guilty. spending that money as they do spending money from their investment portfolio. So, you know, if you have to take money out of your IRA to fund spending, it doesn't feel as good as simply spending money out of, let's say you get a pension, and your pension is going to pay you $50,000 a year on top of Social Security. Do you save that pension money or do you spend most of it? I'm guessing that people, even the aunts, are okay with spending most of that money in retirement. So one of the things that you could do psychologically is you can take money from a lump sum form and turn it into an income stream form. You can actually buy yourself a private pension by buying, say, an income annuity that'll allow you then. And that's one of the reasons why I say you got to get over this idea of holding on to that value of your nest egg, because if the goal is really to live a better lifestyle, then why not give yourself the license to actually be able to spend that money? And one way to do it is by essentially buying a pension, buying some sort of an income that you know is never going to run out, and then you feel like you can always spend the money. I've actually done surveys where I find that retirees, if the market falls, they start cutting back on things like going out to dinner with friends or going on vacations. Those are the things that consistently predict life satisfaction in retirement. And if your retirement plan, your retirement income plan, is not set up in a way that allows you to feel comfortable spending the money no matter what happens in the markets, then again, you're failing because you're not as happy in retirement as you could be.
Maybe another kind of point we could bring up here too is when we have this idea of the four L's, the longevity, which is inflexible spending, lifestyle, the flexible spending, legacy. And then liquidity is this idea of just having reserves for the unexpected spending shocks. And is another concern that you see aside from not liking to spend the nest egg is just not having a sense of what are the spending shocks I might experience. And therefore, I don't really know how much do I need to set aside for spending shocks. And therefore, I don't know how much I can comfortably spend because I don't know how much I need to leave to deal with an emergency. Is that a nuance that you've also picked up with some of those like consumer-based interviews that you've been
doing? Yeah, there was actually a really interesting study that was done recently in Sweden. And it was a comparison of spending among retirees in Sweden to retirees in the United States. And in Sweden, they have government-provided long-term care protection. The hypothesis was that Swedish retirees would spend more because they had that protection. They didn't have to hoard assets because of the possibility that they may have to cover an extended long-term care visit. And in fact, that's exactly what they found, that by having that protection, it freed them up to be able to spend more in retirement. And isn't that a better way to live? And that's one of the advantages of any sort of insurance that protects against these spending shocks in retirement, is you can just buy away that anxiety, and then you're free to spend the remainder of your savings without having to constantly worry that you need to hoard in order to cover that potential, unlikely but very significant expense.
Mm-hmm. And even, well, for this issue of like thinking about how much do I need to set aside, of course, like insurance could be part of that, long-term care insurance and so forth. But even setting that aside, just trying to be more intentional with, okay, let's plan for if I could comfortably manage 5 years in a nursing home, I'll carve that out, I'll set that aside in terms of how I think about it. Now maybe I can feel more comfortable spending the remainder because I know I've now quantified the decision of how much this might cost or how much I want to feel comfortable having set aside to manage this type of risk. Of course, I guess people could always get into the issue of, well, maybe I plan for 5 years, but what if I really need 6 years? But if you could define a scenario that you're then comfortable, okay, I can manage that, that might also be able to help people spend more intentionally with the other assets. That's our hope, at least, with how we kind of frame some of this conversation when we talk about things like the funded ratio for retirement, which actually, going back to a point you made at the beginning when you mentioned Rick Miller, this idea of if you can fund your goals without taking market risk, it's not to say that you shouldn't take market risk, but that could be a great benchmark. And that's, I think, an important way when we talk about a funded ratio for retirement. Do you have enough assets that if you invested, and we like to use TIPS for that, Treasury Inflation Protected Securities, so they provide an inflation-adjusted return, could you fund all your liabilities, including inflexible and flexible spending, if there is a legacy goal that you specifically want to quantify, and then what you want to set aside for reserves to cover the unexpected spending shocks. If you're funded, that means you don't have to take market risk to fund those goals. And then I think that can really help people start to think about framing the issue of, do I want to take market risk? And if so, do I want to take it only for the discretionary wealth above and beyond what I need? Do I want to take market risk with more of the more beyond that as well? But I think that was a great point that you made earlier in the conversation.
Well, that's the way insurance companies think. When they have a general account portfolio, they allocate safe investments to fund their expected future liabilities. So they have actuaries who can estimate when they're going to have to pay out on life insurance policies and annuities. They figure out how much they're going to have to spend in the future, and then they invest in bonds that will mature and cover that exact dollar amount in the future when they need that expense. But some insurance companies have a surplus, and they invest, you know, they make sure that they can cover all of their expected future liabilities. But then with a surplus, they can take greater investment risk. And the amount of investment risk they take is really a function of how flexible they want to be with that portion of their investment portfolio. How much do they want to be able to grab for the potential of a higher return, but also accept the possibility of losing a significant amount of that extra? But I think it's a great way of thinking. I think that starting with, can I cover everything that I need in retirement, then making sure that those liabilities are taken care of with low risk assets, and then thinking about what is the best strategy for the excess above the amount of money that I have to reserve at the beginning. That's, to me, a better approach. I really like Rick's definition of what it means to have what's known as risk capacity. You have the capacity to take greater risk, because and that's another big fallacy that I think, you know, Wade, I cannot believe it when I hear it. This idea that you have a required rate of return that's needed to meet your financial goals. And if you're very far away from meeting your financial goals, then you have to take more investment risk. That is so consistent with economic theory and our experience of financial markets in the past. When you take more risk, all it does is it increases the range of potential outcomes. And, you know, even whether you're saving for an income 5 years in the future for retirement, or whether you're saving for those future spending goals, when you take greater risk, you have a greater variation in the potential lifestyle that you're going to be able to lead in the future. And it's never appropriate for someone who's not close to meeting their lifestyle goal to suggest that they take even greater risk, because that means that their downside is going to cut even further into their inflexible expenses.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's that taking that Hail Mary pass and hoping it pays off and gets an incremental increase in the chance the plan works, but also
So Michael, you're saying if I only buy 5 lottery tickets, not to buy 10?
Well, it's a lottery ticket approach to financial planning. It is the idea that, you know, if you're far away from meeting your goals, then why not throw the Hail Mary rather than readjusting what those goals are and being realistic and telling people that they have to wait
to retire.
I think
it's one of those Pascal's problem, you know, like the dilemma. I think it has a name to it, that if you're so far away, you might as well just gun it, you know, in some weird way. It's one of those sayings. I can't remember it off the top of my head right now, but it has a term, actually. But
yeah, I think it's, you know, the thing is, like, it's like you're the gambler. You're sitting at the table, you know, you start out with $1,000. You're now down to $500, and the only way to get back to where you started is to take even more risk. And you're not thinking, well, the reason I got down to $500 is because I took too much risk and it was not a good idea. You know, it's trying to get back to where you started, but that's just not the right way to approach investment planning.
100%.
And I hear it all the time, you know, this whole concept of a required rate of return to meet your financial goals. I wish we could just get rid of it as a profession. It doesn't make any sense.
I think it sounds kind of quantitative. It sounds like something an advisor would say, you know, and you can put it on an Excel and back into what that number would be, and then magically create an allocation based on historical returns and say, you see, we can get you here like this. as opposed to 23% REITs will bump it up to 34% REITs. You know what I mean? You start playing around like that, and it gives this false sense of security and precision, which is more bad than good. I think a better angle would be kind of, I'm going to give you a softball, would be, okay, let's assume, let's try to get some of these foundational pieces in place. And Wade, you were talking a little bit about maybe funding something for a five-year period or something like that. But, you know, this is where a QLAC can work wonders. No, but I'm serious. I know it's kind of a running joke with Michael and his sort of circle, but he's right. He's right, you know, in a major way that, you know, something like this could just amplify your spending in your earlier years in retirement, knowing that you have something like this in place. You may want to go into that a little bit, Michael.
No, thank you so much for giving me the opportunity to talk about qualified longevity insurance.
It's your Sally Field moment. It's your Sally Field
Your hat there. Your QLAC hat.
Yeah, I was just looking for my QLAC hat.
There it is.
Let's take a moment and talk about qualified
He actually has a cap that says QLAC on it.
You can get anything on Amazon. So what is it? I think it's a good way to talk about this idea of longevity risk and the concept that it's so much cheaper to pool income later on in retirement rather than trying to do it yourself. So, you know, you're not going to be as likely to be alive after the age of 85, but you could be alive. So let's say you're a healthy 90-year-old, or sorry, a healthy 65-year-old woman. You got a 50-50 chance that you're going to make it to the age of 90. You know, you've got a 27% chance you're going to make it to 95. You've got a 10% chance you're going to make it to 100. So what is the best strategy? Is the best strategy to set money aside to cover those spending liabilities at the beginning of retirement? If that's the case, then you won't have very much money to spend today. Or you could pool that longevity risk with other retirees by buying essentially a pension that begins at the age of 85. So you could, for $145,000 today, you could maybe buy $40,000 of income that starts at the age of 85. That makes retirement income planning a lot easier because you got that on top of Social Security. You're not spending a whole lot of money when you're 85 anyway.
There you go. That's the key. You're not spending a lot. You're not moving around a lot when you're 85. You're just not.
You probably got some money, but at least it gives you a foundation of income to cover your basic expenses later on in life. But that frees you up. It gives you a finite planning horizon early on in retirement. So if you retire at 65, I've only got then 20 years that I got to worry about funding. I can either fund those with safe investments like bonds. I can fund them with stocks. I could maybe buy an income annuity that's going guaranteed income up to the age of 85, and then that QLAC's going to bump up that income at 85 to account for some of the impacts of inflation on my income over time. You know, it's a very efficient way to generate later life income, and in a QLAC form, you actually get an additional tax break if you buy one within your IRA.
Now, I would think everything that you've spoken about, and I think, Wade, you said it earlier, you know, where about the 4% rule and this and that, you can come across as being this doom and gloom person, but that's quite the opposite. What I hope folks are picking up on with regards to retirement spending is that we're actually proponents of getting you to spend more, and there's actually quite efficient ways of getting you to spend more. And why spend more? You know, more money is better than less money in terms of spending, and it could bring about enjoyment. Obviously, there's a concept of funded contentment and such, but the reality is that you'd be remiss. You get to 90 years old and you realize, man, I didn't live the retirement that I could have, and I could have easily have done it, because you've had to always leave, quote unquote, a mental reserve there for the just in case. And I think there's ways to accommodate for that are quite effective. And I hope this is coming across in this podcast that you're actually trying to, with your research, you're actually trying to better the human condition. And I know that sounds like a big sort of phrase and all, but it's the reality. Wade, thoughts?
Yeah, fair enough. And it's the 4% rule idea was just an issue of, it brought this idea of sequence of returns risk to financial planning. But the problem is, it was never meant to be an actual retirement spending strategy. It was more of a research simplification. But because it doesn't allow for any adjustment to how the portfolio performs, It's actually the strategy that maximizes the sequence of returns risk. And so in doing so, it forces you to use a lower distribution rate. And that's where there's so many directions, whether it is using some sort of protected income, whether it's having the flexibility to make adjustments to spending, there are mechanisms available that allow you to spend and enjoy at a level above and beyond the very limited constraints created by this sort of, I'm going to only use a aggressive investment portfolio and consistently adjust my spending for inflation and never make any sort of adjustment to what's happening later in retirement. So it's a starting point, but it's something that we can do so much better than. And
yeah, this is we're pausing for Michael, I guess.
Oh, really? I thought that was your segue to Alex.
That was the
Oh no, I got nothing.
You got nothing.
I kind of just teeing it up for you folks. No, other than saying I agree with Wade. I mean, look, the only thing I would say to what Wade said is somebody could be listening and there's this sort of, okay, there's sequence of return, but we're focusing on the negative side of the distribution of sequence of return. You right. know what? I'm probability based and I want to gun it. And I'm feeling lucky, you know, the Clint Eastwood approach, which is I'm going to focus on the right side of that distribution and get the positive effects of the sequence of return risk. And I smoking if you got them. I mean, I don't have a definitive answer for that.
Yeah, I can phrase that as a question for Michael because it's one of his favorite words. The sequence of returns risk, that's an idiosyncratic risk, right? The market, the market does not reward you it's not a risk that it's very much idiosyncratic. You can't diversify your exposure to sequence of returns risk.
Right. And longevity risk is another example of that, that, you know, you can be exposed to longevity risk, but it's not going to allow you to spend more in retirement. So it you know, you're exposed to the possibility of running out if you live to the age of 100, but that doesn't necessarily allow you to spend more every year because you're exposed to it. In fact, you can spend more if you decide not to expose yourself to that longevity risk. It's why economists say that some form of annuitization is a no-brainer, that there is this annuitization puzzle that people don't take advantage of the opportunity to pool that idiosyncratic longevity risk. And it's, you know, part of this, I think the new thinking about retirement income planning is what are the risks? What are the most efficient way to deal with each one of those risks? How can we set someone up to be able to spend as much money as possible with the least amount of worry? And that's really what it means. You know, that's why we assess things like preferences in retirement so that we can come up with an idea of how much risk are you willing to take in terms of your lifestyle? And then how can we put together some type of a plan that's going to give you the greatest enjoyment that you can from retirement? I think that's actually one of the biggest problems with the defined contribution system is that people get to retirement, they have this big nest egg, they don't feel comfortable spending it, and they're actually less happy than they could be, or they would have been if they would have simply gotten a pension. So they can decide how much they want to keep in a pot of money, how much they want to put into a lifetime income where they can take advantage, get rid of that longevity risk that they're not compensated for taking, and put together a better plan that's going to allow them to feel comfortable actually spending the money. Because you only get one trip through. You only get, what's the term that Mike Zwecker used? One whack at the cat. One.
Yes.
And it's essentially one sequence of investment returns, you know, one maybe 30-year time horizon through retirement. You want to be able to maximize your enjoyment every single one of those years. So you want to create some sort of a financial plan that's going to give you access to the resources that you need to be able to maximize your enjoyment in retirement. That's the whole goal of retirement income planning.
100%, and I think that goes into the, if you flip it around, right? I've read up on it where if someone has a pension, and you tell them you're going to flip them into all of a sudden an investment portfolio, they don't want that, you know. As opposed to, you know, if they have a DC plan and going into a pension, you see this sort of anchoring into the pension. And by the way, I thought you were going to quote Confucius, not Zwecker, in terms of every man has two lives until he realizes he has one.
Alex, you have a much better classical education than I do.
Yes. Well, I don't know about that. I think that wraps it up, Michael. We got you in. This is the second 40-minute plus episode with you. Did you think we could do this the other day?
No. Well, you know, I'm a yakker. I can talk for a long time about this stuff. We probably have a few more episodes in us, actually.
Well, yeah, I was going to ask, you know, we'll wrap it up, but I was going to ask about consumption smoothing since you mentioned Rick Miller, but I thought, you know what? That's like another. That's another thing in and of itself.
Keep the audience at the edge of their seat. Oh my God! An entire episode on consumption smoothing.
More to follow. And Wade, did you notice how Michael did a great job of bringing back preferences? He did He does a better job than us about bringing it back together.
Right.
Understanding. We just kind of meander. All right. Well. Thank you, everyone. And Michael, what can I say? You've been great. It's been an absolute pleasure. So I'll say my goodbyes.
Yeah, thanks,
all right.
Everyone.
Thank you for having me on, Alex.
Oh, yeah. Wade, you want to take us home?
Yeah. Thanks, Michael. Thanks, everyone, for listening. And we'll catch you next week on Retire with Style.
Bye, everyone.
Wade and Alex are both principals in McLean Asset Management and retirement researcher. Both are SEC-registered investment advisors located in Tysons, Virginia. The opinions expressed in this program are for general informational and educational purposes only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual or on any specific securities. To determine which investments may be appropriate for you, consult your financial advisor. All investing comes with a risk, including risk of loss. Past performance does not guarantee future results.